KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, sitting in today for Michael Krasny. Last month, President Obama signed a new education law called the Every Student Succeeds Act. He called it a Christmas miracle because the bill had received such widespread bipartisan support. The new law replaces No Child Left Behind, the education initiative launched by former President George W. Bush. In the hour ahead, we'll explore what changes the new law brings and what it signifies for California's classrooms in particular. Will it stimulate more educational opportunity than its controversial predecessor? Will every child now have a better chance at success, or will many still be left behind? We'll take up that question next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in today for Michael Krasny. In 2002, President George W. Bush, with Ted Kennedy at his side, signed his landmark education initiative into law. It was known as No Child Left Behind and passed with widespread bipartisan support. The law promised to redress what President Bush famously called the soft bigotry of low expectations and required schools to collect data on who was succeeding, who wasn't, and how schools would be sanctioned if they didn't meet accountability standards. But its bipartisan promise was soon swamped by widespread criticism. Too much focus on testing, the critics said, too punitive, too much power for the federal government, and too little funding to achieve its goals. Now President Obama has signed a new education law that replaces No Child Left Behind, a law that comes with an equal amount of bipartisan support and an equally optimistic name, the Every Student Succeeds Act. And so in this hour forum, we want to take a look at what No Child Left Behind achieved, what it didn't, and whether Every Student Succeeds can come any closer to achieving what its lofty title promises. Joining us are Anna Tentakulis, education reporter for KQED News. Anna, good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us as well is Sandy Kress. He was a senior advisor to President George W. Bush and intimately involved in the creation of No Child Left Behind. Today, he is the director of public policy development and outreach at the George W. Bush Institute. Mr. Kress, good morning as well.
Good morning to you.
Happy to have you join us. Joining us here in the studio is David Plank. He's the executive director of PACE, that's Policy Analysis for California Education, which is an independent research center based at Stanford, the University of Southern California, and UC Davis. David, good morning as well.
Good morning.
And joining us too by phone, Eric Hines, president of the California Teachers Association. Eric Hines, good morning to you.
Good morning, Dave.
Well, thanks all very much for joining us. As we begin this new year in 2016, seems like an appropriate time to look ahead to what education may fare and how it will fare here in California. Let's start with just a quick look at the legacy of No Child Left Behind. And I guess I say legacy in part, David Plank, because I don't so much want to conduct an autopsy of what went wrong or what went right with it as what it really told us. Even for critics, is there something that No Child Left Behind really laid bare about how our education system works?
Yes, I think there's both positive and negative in the legacy of No Child Left Behind. The most important positive is I think it cast a very bright light on the gaps in achievement among groups of students, between white students and African-American students, between Latino students and Asian students. And I think that is knowledge that we now have that is not going to go away.
And we didn't know that before because, simply put, that data was not collected?
Sure. We knew it before. Certainly people in the education system knew it quite well. But in terms of public accountability and public knowledge, No Child Left Behind really made that a key goal of the education system, is closing those gaps.
And what would you say its shortcomings were?
I think the most important shortcoming was that it focused almost entirely on sanctions for schools that seemed not to be performing up to standards. It set very ambitious goals for the education system. 100% of children will be proficient in mathematics and English language arts by 2014. That was never an achievable goal. And then when schools began to fall short of that goal, No Child Left Behind relied on sanctions and punishments to try to encourage them to do more. And that turned out to be, I think, a completely wrong-headed strategy.
And Sandy Kress, as someone who was so involved in the creation of No Child Left Behind, what would you agree or disagree with in terms of David Planck's assessment?
Well, a couple of things. I certainly agree that the transparency, the fact that we now know, and in some detail, through state reports, through local reports, the learning results of not only all children, but subgroups, so that we know African-American, we know low-income, we know kids with disabilities. This is a huge advance. Sure, people had an idea. You know, you might get a grade, you might not. Sometimes, but more often than not, this was swept under the rug in broader results for all students. I think this move to disaggregated results for subgroups and this expectation that all subgroups advance, which is really what was behind the name No Child Left Behind, was a real positive in the law. Where I disagree is this notion, and it's commonly believed. I mean, if someone were to take a poll among your radio audience, did No Child Left Behind involve all these horrible sanctions and punishments? I think that would generally be believed to be true. I just don't think it's so. When George Miller, congressman from your area, progressive, Ted Kennedy, and President Bush and others came together with this law, if you look in the law, you see that there are consequences. But it's only because it's been sold as punishment. The consequences, are they deemed punishment? Essentially, they were fix it up. I mean, the ideas were school improvement. You were identified as in need of improvement. There was a lot of give and a lot of this business of one size fits all is just completely false. Local districts, states had tremendous choice and flexibility in what to do with school improvement. And there was very little forced. Typically, it meant developing a plan. It meant improving teacher skills. It meant giving children more alternatives. It meant reconstituting the school. Only in our world of bureaucracy and government are those things seen as punishments. Schools probably were over-labeled toward the end. The law was 7 years overdue in reauthorization. That was a problem, but the law should have been fixed. But where in the world how in the world do we get to a place where low achievement levels for low-income or African-American kids needing to be responded to with fixes? Where in the world would we come up with the idea that that's a punishment?
Yeah. Well, let's dig in from there then and begin to talk some about the differences between No Child Left Behind and the Every Student Succeeds Act, which now takes its place. And let's begin by talking some about this question of fixing, because Eric Hines with the Teachers Association, it's still clear, of course, that there are many schools and many students who are still underachieving. And as I understand it, one of the principal differences between the new law and its predecessor is that while there are some interventions or there are some standards that have to be met or interventions will take place, it's left far more open. Is that correct? They're not as proscribed as they were under No Child Left Behind.
Well, I think that's true, and I think what the important thing of what it does is that it pushes what the accountability system looks like and how to intervene in schools. It pushes this to the state level and in a way that the keeps the federal government kind of more out of it. And in fact, the outcome, when we looked at No Child Left Behind and what really happened, and I can only I can talk from my own experience as a teacher who's taught before that and who's taught through it, was in fact an over-reliance on testing and a focus on the high stakes, because there was a lot of one size kind of four different interventions that were allowed for schools that were labeled as failing schools and really didn't address the needs. If a school needed more resources or if a school actually needed to bring up the achievement of certain subgroup of students or any students, in fact, just the opposite happened. They had a change of – they disrupted the entire school by reconstitution, which means that you let go all the teachers in that school and they all have to reapply for their job, which creates a lot of disruption in a school where actually they need more stability. What we like about the Every Student Succeeds Act is that we can now focus, we get away from this punishment model, kind of label and punish, and more we can focus on what we're doing here in California, which is focusing on continuous growth, looking at schools through not just one single test score, but through a broad range of multiple measures or a dashboard of indicators, which is better than focusing on just one single number that you do in the end of the year, which is not really helpful and doesn't really improve anyone's teaching or student learning.
We're going to hear in just a little bit from Anna Santoklis and David Plank as well about what some California schools are trying to do to develop that more diverse and comprehensive set of standards for accountability. But before we get to that, David Plank, say something more about this question of states versus federal, which does seem to be such at the heart of this change. It's ironic in some ways when you think back to 2002 that George W. Bush, a Republican, would be a big proponent of federal power, in a sense. Not surprising that Ted Kennedy would have thought that. Now we're coming all the way around again. Is that both an opportunity, but also perhaps a sense of peril in that states can be kind of free maybe not to do much either?
It's a very good question. I think that what we see is, you're quite right, it's a reversal of course, back to a much more state-centered education system. We tried heavy-handed federal interventions in No Child Left Behind, and we found that that was not successful. In the nature of public policy, we've now turned 180 degrees, and we're now handing this back to the states. There is great opportunity there for a state like California that is working very hard on developing a new accountability system that will be much more supportive of schools and that will support continuous improvement in the performance of schools. But there's also great peril in that the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, of which No Child Left Behind was the most recent version, was passed in the first place to address the fact that states were not taking seriously the challenges of their least advantaged students, minority students, poor students. And the federal policy over the years has sought to ensure that those students get a fair shake in the education system. Handing a lot of responsibility back to the states runs the risk that some states will revert to past behavior and will not address the needs of those students in the way that many of us would like to see.
David Plank is the executive director of PACE, Policy Analysis for California Education. He joins us, as is Anna Santoklis, the education reporter for KQED News. And Anna, let's turn then for a moment to what California may do with this. In some ways, California has already been trying to develop some of its own approaches to the question of accountability standards in particular. And there are a number of districts, including San Francisco, Oakland, and Sacramento, that are trying to develop this new way of assessing whether or not a school is succeeding or failing. Tell us something about that effort.
Right. Well, California, as you mentioned, is already in this process of changing its school accountability system. And so in many ways, this law catches everyone up to where California is heading. A lot of states are now looking to California. And I think it was David Plank who said it kind of now formalizes and legalizes the flexibilities that we've already kind of claimed. So what California is working on right now is going back to this term of a dashboard of measurements. It's kind of like if you think of the dashboard on a car where you're like monitoring different factors like the gas and speedometer. In the case of schools, those factors include things like test scores, but also, you know, college readiness, graduation rates, school climate, suspension rates, among other things. And so so the new law, the ESSA, or Every Student Succeeds Act, is also embracing this more kind of holistic approach to measuring, although there is a potential source of conflict because it's still asking for all these factors to be boiled down into some kind of rating or number. And that's where California's could have a big problem with the federal government as it moves forward.
Sandy Chris, what do you think? As someone who helped create No Child Left Behind, what do you think of this idea of giving states a lot more flexibility? In some ways, that's a philosophy that would have been consistent with most Republicans. I know by history you're a Democrat, but you were closely associated with a Republican president. Do you like that idea of more flexibility? Do you like the idea of this dashboard concept of multiple measures of success as opposed to trying to focus in on a particular number like test scores?
Well, thank you for asking, David. I appreciate the chance to go back into some of the answers that were just given. I had a lot to do with writing the law. I mean, I was there at the table with Charlie Barone, who many of you may know, who was Congressman Miller's assistant, and all of Ted Kennedy's staff, as well as the Republicans. And what we wrote, which I know pretty intimately, bears very little resemblance to the account of it that has been given on this in this conversation so far. The first thing, I guess, that baffles me is this notion that somehow the federal government came in and demanded that states and local districts impose consequences like getting rid of all teachers, completely unsettling the school to its own detriment, and so forth and so on. This is simply not true. The decisions that were made to develop these consequences or implement them were made almost entirely by local districts and by states. I actually, after I left the White House, I went out and advised the chief state school officers on how they could develop huge flexibility within their accountability systems in response to No Child Left Behind. And this idea that the feds made me do it, made me shut down the school, made me get rid of all these teachers, made me, drill and kill in terms of testing and one size fits all. This is just myth. I mean, we don't have time on this program to go through all the different provisions of the law.
Yeah, if I might interject just for a moment, I understand that. And I suspect rather strongly that over the course of the next 35 minutes in this program or so, we're not going to resolve the legacy of No Child Left Behind. I understand your strong defense of what it did do and that some of it has been unfairly characterized. But I would like you to address, if you could, please, going from here.
Yeah. No, I understand. But I had to at least lay that predicate to make the point, because I think the real issue with the new law, the real concern with the new law, and what I think drove George Miller to support the law that was passed, No Child Left Behind, is that states and districts absolutely should have tremendous flexibility in terms of what they do. The question, really, the fundamental question on the table, is whether there's any federal pressure to do more to close achievement gaps, to take certain actions, certain corrective actions, to change, use all kinds of alternative measures, and look at a dashboard, look at a whole variety of ways of measuring achievement. But if on objective measures, for example, African-American youngsters are not reading anywhere near grade level or doing math anywhere near grade level, should there be pressure to the districts and states from the federal government to do something different, to do something more effective? That pressure, that's the real issue here.
Yeah, and you're saying that pressure is not there?
Left behind. That pressure is no longer imposed by the federal government. And I think we're going to go back to ways of behaving that are not in the best interest of disadvantaged kids.
Eric Hines, pick up on that, because that's a strong argument. You know, Sandy Kress is saying there's no hammer and there needs to be one.
Well, you know, I think, you know, my experience of the law as a teacher and this whole concept of the one size fits all and whether they're punishments or however, I don't impinge anybody what their intention was in writing the law. I only know what the outcome was in my school and how it affected students in my school and what I was asked to do as a teacher. And that was a one size fits all scripted curriculum where the focus was on what page I was on, and it was focused only on language arts and math. And I think I totally agree that we can't go back to what was before, and we need to be able to address the needs of students that have been traditionally underserved, and where the data has been traditionally hidden in this broader data picture. But if you're going to do that, you have to use the right kind of data. Mm-hmm. And using a single test score was not, just by itself, was not really going to give us. It may have shed a light on the picture, but if you really wanted to focus on what students needed, you needed a broader picture than that, and that's why the whole concept of the dashboard. Now, we have a responsibility, of course, to hold ourselves, our own feet to the fire to be able to do that And that's why here in California, as we're building a new accountability system, we are actively looking to address that particular issue as well, so that we don't leave those child. You know, it should be that nobody wants a bad teacher in front of a school. Nobody wants a student not to learn. But if you're going to do that, you want to focus on the right kinds of drivers that helps kids learn, and the right kinds of interventions that actually address the needs of students to learn, regardless of which zip code they're in.
David Plank, if there isn't a lot in the way of consequence, Sandy Kress's point here, if there isn't much of a hammer, it's well and good to say that we need to have these better accountability, more diverse, broader accountability standards. Well and good to say we need to hold our feet to the fire. But if no one else is holding our feet to the fire, that's problematic, isn't it?
I think the real question is who can most effectively wield that hammer? What the new law has done is to hand that responsibility back to the states. The question is, how big a role must the federal government play in ensuring that states do the right thing and that states ensure that their school districts do the right thing? I think with No Child Left Behind, we learned that the federal government is not very good at this kind of work, that the kinds of interventions that the federal government required turned out not to be very effective in changing schools. And so shifting to the states, as you noted earlier, does entail some risks if states don't pick up the hammer, if they don't take this responsibility seriously. But it really creates opportunities for states to create new ways of ensuring accountability that may work better than the previous one.
And Anna Tentakulos, in these pilot groups, these small number of districts here in California that are currently trying to create this, how are they dealing with that question of consequence? How are they dealing with if the dashboard doesn't read right, if your tank is on empty at a particular school, what are they saying is going to happen?
Well, not much. I think you're right. I think the question remains, like, what kind of interventions or what type of, let's be honest, what kind of sanctions might be developed? I mean, I think California's in this new world of, like, getting away of being punitive and being more in the approach of let's support you. Let's figure out what is wrong. What supports can we build around this school? What training do we need to give to teachers? So in many respects, that's a good thing. I mean, that's, you want education to have this kind of positive culture because I think there is a big feeling that No Child Left Behind did create this teach to the test culture. In these kind of districts, such as San Francisco, who's piloting this new accountability approach, I mean, I think they have a waiver, so they're free of a lot of the mandates that NCLB has placed on districts that, don't have a waiver. But it's still very new, and they've just created this index, and a lot of it dovetails and is compatible with the general direction California's taken. They're going beyond a one-dimensional focus on test scores, and they're trying to develop priorities like school climate, parent and teacher engagement. But it's still it's very unclear how this will all roll out.
All right, we'll hold it there and come back and talk more about how these standards will play out, what kinds of consequences will take place if schools aren't able to uphold them. Talk about the whole question of testing and the role that plays in education when we come back. We'd like you to join our conversation. You can do so by giving us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson, and today for Michael Krasny. Our topic this hour, the legacy of No Child Left Behind, the landmark education initiative that was signed into law by former President George W. Bush back in 2002, and its successor, the Every Student Succeeds Act, which President Obama signed into law just before Christmas. Both had widespread bipartisan support, and we're focusing this hour on what the new law may change here in California and whether or not, indeed, every child will now have a better chance at success. You can join our conversation at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to us at forum@kqed.org. You can post them on our website, which is kqed.org/forum, also on our Facebook page. I want to spend a moment more on what California is now doing. For parents and teachers who are listening to this program, David Plank, I'm curious about what change may be brewing here in California. We have these so-called core districts, these 9 districts in California that are currently experimenting, trying to come up with their own dashboard, as Anna Tentakulos called it, way of looking at defining whether or not a school or students succeed. What are the specifics of that? What's unique? What's innovative? What excites you as an educator about what is trying to be figured out here in California?
Well, it's interesting to me that in California, we're having a conversation that is very much parallel to the conversation between the federal government and the states, which is under the local control funding formula. Governor Brown delegated most of the authority and responsibility in California's education system to local school districts, greatly diminished the role of the state in defining policy direction and in holding districts accountable. And we're living with the consequences of that, as we will live with them at the federal level, in that most districts accept that responsibility willingly and are picking it up and moving forward. But some districts may not. And we have a conversation now in California about what happens if local authorities don't accept the responsibility that the state has given them to ensure success for all students. Who wields the hammer? What does the hammer look like if support turns out to be insufficient? So I think it's interesting that we, in the last 3 years in California, have been through a discussion that is very much like the conversation we're about to have between the federal government and the states. In response to more directly to your other question, in California, we have a group of districts that are known as the core districts. And they, a few years ago, received a waiver from the received individual waivers, but worked together from the federal government under the provisions of No Child Left Behind, which allowed them to develop their own innovative accountability system. And that accountability system is focused on what they call the right drivers of student success and is oriented towards supporting continuous improvement in the performance of schools and students in their districts. That system really sets the pattern for what the state of California is trying to do with respect to our new accountability system, in that it puts in place a dashboard of indicators. It provides different kinds of support for schools that are not performing well. And it relies on local leadership, on the superintendent of the district, to wield the hammer when the hammer has to be made.
Tell me something about some of the specifics of that so-called dashboard. Anna mentioned some of the things that could be included, graduation rates. Those are you can understand. Those seem quantifiable to me. But some of them, like this question of school climate, seem a lot harder to get your arms around. I understand the basic idea that schools will be judged in part by whether or not students feel welcome, whether they do a good job of kind of giving students an opportunity to feel like they can succeed, encouraging resilience, that kind of thing. But that seems awfully hard to sort of put a number on. And in the end, don't you have to at least try to assign something quantifiable if you're really going to decide whether or not a school is working?
Yes. So the core districts have designed an accountability system that includes 3 big elements. The first of those, and the most important, is students' academic achievement. The second is school climate. And the third is what they call social-emotional learning, which would be, for example, resilience, grit, perseverance, academic mindset. And this really is pioneering work. This is not work that has gone on elsewhere, certainly not at the system level where districts have tried to incorporate those kinds of measures into a formal accountability system. And CORE has relied on some of the measures that you talked about, on graduation rates, on reclassification rates for English language learners, on fairly standard measures of school performance, and assigned those to school climate or to social-emotional learning. But they have also done a lot of work to survey students and teachers about what's going on in their schools and how they feel about the learning process and their opportunities to succeed. And they have built those indicators into their accountability system as well.
I want to go to our calls in just a moment. But before we do, let me get you, Sandy Kress, to respond to that. The notion, and it makes sense to me, that how a student feels about being in school may have a lot to do with whether or not that student can succeed in school. Does that strike you as a good way to go, or does it strike you as sort of touchy-feely Californian-ness?
Well, listen, it is important. You know, we've done a lot of work at the Bush Institute on how to make middle grades, middle schools work more effectively. You know, how a student feels and how a student is treated matters a great deal. The question is whether it's an output that can be measured and used in an accountability system or whether it has something to do with what you do to improve that student's life and success. I'm not at all convinced that there'll be a way to measure it as an output, and it worries me. It seems to me that it's something absolutely, however, that needs to be done. By the way, I want to keep striking this note at the risk of being of repeating myself. These are all issues that could have been considered, and in many places were considered under the old NCLB regime. I want to say too that it's important. I want to just keep striking this note that if we find better ways of doing accountability, then we'll get a lot of we'll do a lot of good things for our young people. If, on the other hand, we move away from accountability into other areas, and this is a possibility here with this issue that you've raised, where we're less rigorous about getting students to the kind of results they need to get, we will lose these gains that we've made, not just from NCLB, but from accountability systems. All the research shows students are doing better because of accountability. We need to be sure that we're rigorous as we move forward with these criteria.
And to our calls, let's start with Mashurika here in San Francisco. Go ahead with your question, please.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. I think this conversation is very timely, especially in San Francisco, where applications for our public schools will be happening on January 15th. So thank you for having this conversation today. And my organization, Parents for Public Schools of San Francisco, we're really interested in learning about how ESSA will shift the way we think about family engagement. I'd love to hear from your presenters how they are thinking about the role of family engagement in our children's education moving forward.
Thank you, Mashurika. Eric Hines, why don't you take that? How do teachers feel about the importance of engaging families, parent engagement in particular, in the classroom?
Sure. Well, I want to clarify the one thing that's kind of a little maybe confusing, but what the core districts are doing, core is not implementing something what's new for a California accountability system. They are the districts that receive federal waivers with a consulting company, you know, core, and they're doing their thing and trying to experiment. The Department of Education and the State Board of Education are working on the California accountability system, and they may take, you know, parts of what CORE is doing, and certainly that's, you know, the pilot program, but that's not – the state work is going on independent of what's happening in the CORE districts.
Understood.
And secondly, the part of parent engagement – now, you know, California has done something pretty historic, and that's what when the governor implemented the local control funding formula and gave the money to the school districts and the students and the districts to decide how actually to implement program and all of that by the, you know, the people that actually know the names of the students that they serve. And part of that, as the accountability of how that money is spent, the districts have to develop a local control accountability plan. And as part of that plan, that actually requires parent and community engagement to build those accountability plans. And as part of the 8 focus areas, community engagement is an extremely important part of it, and teachers welcome that. They think that having their parents and the community as partners in working with the students really enhances the not just the understanding of what the students need and so on, but really enhances their ability to succeed.
Are there any innovations going on, Anna Tentakulis, maybe you can take this, and David Plank, you may want to chime in this too, on how to improve or encourage parent education in low-income areas, in areas where traditionally there's been perhaps more alienation between parents and their school districts? It's one thing to have parental engagement in Menlo Park and another thing to have strong parental engagement in a less well-to-do area. And are you aware of efforts among any of the core districts, these districts that are trying to pilot some new ideas along those lines?
Yeah. One way is, you know, it's just kind of the basics. It's knocking on parents' doors. A lot of districts are creating these kind of home visit programs where at a school site, teachers or kind of an academic team will pinpoint certain families, go to their house, knock on their door, and just kind of create almost like a case in building relationships, understanding how that student is faltering, what kind of supports that student needs. And it also, you know, at the same time, you're getting parents to really become more invested in their child's education, and there's more of a connection there. I think districts are still trying to figure out, though, the best way to engage families. I mean, you know, for obviously schools and families go hand in hand, but the question is how can you really use the ideas and the thoughts that parents have and use them to push schools forward academically. And I think for a long time, schools or in districts would engage families on a certain level and say, okay, you know, that's great, but we're going to go ahead and do what we think is best. But now they're required to actually take these ideas and institutionalize them in some way using evidence-based strategies. And so I think the first time you are having genuine conversations, real authentic conversations about what parents think will help their students succeed and schools succeed. But, you know, some of these are just informal meetings. Some of them are not. Some are more, you know, district mandated meetings and parents show up. But parents are very busy, obviously, yep. And they're leaving very busy lives. So how can you also just capture them and also, you know, connect them for a sustainable amount of time?
Anna Tentakla's education reporter for KQED News, joining us. We hope you will join us as well. You can by giving us a call at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786 to Nancy in Berkeley. Nancy, go ahead.
Hi. I'm listening to this and just getting angrier and angrier. I have teachers who are friends, and it just, you know, you talk about teacher accountability. What about the United States government and the state government on accountability? Nothing's going to change in the schools until teachers are valued and paid a decent wage. I mean, teachers who teach in San Francisco can't even live in San Francisco. Programs are being cut. Emeryville has no program for autistic children. Oakland is closing their programs for children who have special needs and wanting to mainstream them. Classes are overcrowded. Teachers have no money in which to do something with the kids in their class. They're using their own money. You know, and all you do is talk about teacher accountability. It makes me sick.
Okay, Nancy.
And not only that, but it's a community problem. You know, people are homeless. You know, how you expect children to do well in class when their parents are worried about where their next meal is coming from.
We hear your point. Let's get some reaction to it. Because David Plank, Nancy does raise an important point here, and we haven't talked about that. And I suspect there isn't anything magic in the Every Student Succeeds Act that's going to pay teachers more and reduce class size, right? I mean, those fundamental concerns, which have to do certainly with how well students do, aren't necessarily something that's going to be fixed by this new law.
That's right. The law really addresses issues of accountability, assessment, intervention in schools that are not performing well. It does not address the larger problem of whether we're spending enough on our education system, whether we give teachers the respect that they're due, whether we provide them with the support that they need to be successful with their students. So it's a limited law. Federal policy in education, it's a limited role. It's 7% of the total. In California, we're trying to deal with these issues, but we have certainly not provided adequate funding for our schools, and that is an issue that remains to be addressed somewhere in the future. Right now, we're talking about a much more limited set of interventions.
It's an important reminder that as we talk about education, there are many, many aspects of improving and fixing our schools, improving the odds for children. And of course, this law only addresses one facet of that multifaceted dilemma.
But, Elizabeth, if I could interject. I think this idea, though, that there will be multiple measures does take a huge pressure off teachers, because we've lived in this era of, you know, test scores. And I think there's broad consensus now that just looking at that data, there's just so much more that is going on inside a school. And so even the Obama administration went on record saying states are testing their students too much. So I think that just takes a lot of pressures off, and that might, you know, somehow seep into public perception.
Fair enough. I mean, in other words, your point that while it may not improve the size of a teacher's paycheck, it takes some stress off of what teachers have dealt with. Perhaps someone else was trying to get in a point. Who was that?
Yeah, that was
Sandy.
Eric here.
Sandy, go ahead.
Yeah. I'm very sympathetic with this call, and I frankly think that it's not an answer to this caller to say that we're going to go to multiple measures. I mean, we might have multiple measures. This is not a matter of – listen, teachers and adults generally need to be under pressure to do better by our children. If we don't do better by our children, then shame on us. The question that the caller's making – the point the caller's making is we need to do more to support our teachers. We need, as a community, to do more to come into the school and deal with problems that the school can't handle. Senator Graham from Florida, the Democrat, and I talked about this when No Child Left Behind was going through, and I wish we could have done more. We did do more in Dallas when I was on the school board about bringing youth and family service centers to bear to help teachers and help schools deal with out-of-school problems that would help the schools and teachers deal with in-school problems by doing so. So it's just simply not an answer to say, well, we're going to look at these other measures and take pressures off. We need to go in and help schools and help teachers, and there's no reason why communities in the Bay Area, all across the country, can't organize themselves better so that all of the agencies of government, local, state, and federal, all the nonprofits, work together far more effectively and efficiently as we did in Dallas and other places have, to solve problems more cohesively, more holistically, more fully, that are hurting families and hurting kids and make it hard for teachers to succeed.
Sandy Kress commenting on the experience he had with No Child Left Behind, but also what he thinks still needs to be done. Fair points all. Get to some of our emails here. Kurt writes in, No Child Left Behind taught us that the federal government needs to stay out of education, even to the point of abolishing the Department of Education. I'm not saying the federal government doesn't have a role. They run the service academies and other things, but everything else is pretty much under local, state, and private control. Another listener writes, for 30 minutes, I've heard arguments back and forth about who should have the power or whether a failed school should be labeled so. No one has really addressed how to give kids a better environment to thrive. For me, the new law sounds like yet another politically driven agenda that leverages the broken education system to gain votes rather than really trying to fix it. And Hannah asks, does the panel think that Common Core will make it harder for states to hide the achievement gap when compared to other states? David Plank, Hannah's bringing up the question of Common Core, which is this idea that has had a big change in the kind of curricula that's now taught in the schools, and that the Obama administration, particularly Secretary of Education Duncan, was very much pushing. This new law is neutral on Common Core. It says that, well, in fact, you don't have to go that way. What's your sense of that?
I think that what this new law may do is to draw some of the political pressure away from Common Core. States, I believe 48 states now, have adopted new academic standards, higher academic standards, in response to the Common Core initiative. Not all of them are Common Core standards. Some states adopted Common Core and then withdrew. Other states have changed their standards on their own. But all of the states have moved to adopt higher standards. And I don't think we're going to move away from that. I think what this new law may do is simply take away the idea that this is a federal imposition, that the federal government's making us do it. The federal government is not making you do it. And leave the higher standards in place.
To our next caller, Diane joins us from South Carolina. Diane, go ahead.
Yes. I'm a professor at the University of South Carolina and spend a lot of time in the schools here. I'm an education professor. And with this law, as well as South Carolina's recent law, I think that the issue of accountability, of using a hammer, is coming at this from the wrong direction. I think that governments at all levels need to be asking, what is it that we can do to ensure that all children have access to ample text that they can read? How do we ensure that all children have access to a teacher who's well-educated? How do we ensure that all teachers work for a principal who's well-educated? How do we ensure that all school boards have the background they need to make the decision to hire superintendents who know what they're doing? I have been in schools in which the school bus driver was teaching first grade because they could not get any teacher to work in that district, not even a sub.
So, Diane, yeah, thank you. You raised interesting points. I'd like Eric Hines to respond as the president of the California Teachers Association on this question, Eric, of teacher accountability. As one of our earlier callers noted, there was, you know, concern that teachers would be, and Anna Tsentakalos made this point as well, that teachers would be evaluated, had been evaluated perhaps too much based on how well their kids did on testing. You said earlier that as head of the teachers union, you do believe that it's important to hold teachers accountable, to make sure the teachers, as our caller suggests, are able to teach the classes they teach. How do you see that issue going forward? What will the teachers union support in terms of making sure that the teachers who are in our schools, in fact, deserve to be there?
Well, in fact, you know, I think this also addresses not just this last caller, but the caller before that around the system accountability. When we look at accountability, teachers, you know, are not afraid of being held accountable. Nobody wants, you know, a bad teacher teaching the students, and none of my colleagues I know, there's not a single one who wants that. But if you're going to, you can't focus the entire accountability on just the teacher, which has been the narrative that's come out of, one of the narratives that's come out of No Child Left Behind. If we just got rid of the bad teachers and we used the test scores, which were an inaccurate measure of effective or ineffective, to focus on that. In fact, if we're looking at an accountability system, it can't just focus on teachers or the school. It's got to look at the system. And if a school is not performing the way we want it to perform, given all those indicators, you have to look at, well, is the system providing enough resources for the school? Is poverty an issue? Is you know, are any of those other things that are going on in a system? Then how do we fix, you know, or support where the growth happens? Part of what's happened in some of the country, and not in California, fortunately, is that this whole focus on testing under No Child Left Behind, they have been inappropriately using the test scores to evaluate as part of the evaluation of the teachers, which is what they were never designed to do. Now, in California, we are looking at a broader system of accountability. When I say multiple measures, what I also mean in terms of a dashboard is holding the system accountable itself, because we know the things that will help a school. Things like poverty make a difference. Under No Child Left Behind, the part of the narrative that came out of that, whether intended or not, was that poverty was just simply an excuse. If you mention poverty, but we know that that actually is an impact student learning. We need to get back to the things that actually help improve teaching and improve student learning. And those are the indicators that we need to look at and focus on. And that includes the whole system and the community and the whole kit and caboodle, so to speak.
And let's get to another caller. Risa joins us next in San Francisco. Risa, go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks so much for taking the call. I have no children in the school, in any school yet, so I may be misinformed on this, but my understanding is the school funding is tied to property taxes at the local level. And to me, if that is indeed the case, that this is the elephant in the room. How can we change a system which is so entrenched in the real estate prices, and, you know, people pay double, triple for a home in a good school district, expecting that their children will
right. Risa, let me hold you there just because we're short on time. We can't really divert into the whole question, David Plank, of school funding. But actually, there was a pretty significant change in the school funding formula that the legislature passed, Governor Brown supported, in this past year. So the funding is now not strictly tied to local property taxes.
No, in fact, the funding works in exactly the opposite way to the description of the caller, which is to say that districts that educate a lot of poor students or English learners or foster youth receive more money from the state than districts that have more advantaged populations. So we've actually reversed the problem that the caller's identifying.
Spend our last moment or two just getting a quick final thought from each of you, if I might, about what you have hopes for in terms of the Every Student Succeeds Act and what you think is the most crucial thing that actually would benefit children, whether that's here in California or nationwide. And just have time for a very quick thought from each of you on that. Sandy Kress first.
Well, I hope that we're rigorous about holding ourselves accountable. I hope that we continue to try to find, through the research that was started under No Child Left Behind, the effective strategies that help teachers succeed. And I worry a little bit about whether we're going to continue to do that or not. And I hope that we find solutions to help teachers, not only with doing better in the classroom, but the issue that we talked about a moment ago, that we understand our obligations as a community to deal with young people and their families so that they can succeed, have a chance to succeed in school and outside of school.
And Eric Hines, I'm afraid I'm just going to give you 10 seconds.
Yes, well, sure. So we get away from politicizing this issue. It's not about right and left, but it's about what's right and wrong, and focus about what actually works, that actually focuses on the students and improving student learning and teaching.
And David Plank.
I hope that the federal government will not interfere with the excellent work that's going on in California. We're moving in the right direction, and the federal government could help us or hinder us, and I hope they'll help us.
And Aniston Toklas, real quick, what are you going to be watching for in the year ahead?
I think I'll watch whether the state's accountability system will complement the federal system and no longer butt heads, but work together.
Thanks all very much for this important discussion about how education will proceed in the year ahead. We want to thank our producers, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Judy Campbell, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Jim Bennett. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.